We want our children to have the best chance to live fulfilling lives. But can you keep up with all the books and scientific research on parenting and fit the information into your own philosophy on how to raise kids? Welcome to Your Parenting Mojo, the podcast that does the work for you by investigating and examining respectful, research-based parenting tools to help kids thrive. Now, welcome your host, Jen Lumenlon.
Welcome to the Your Parenting Mojo podcast. We have a bit of a different episode lined up today. We're going to look at the book Your Spiritual Child by Dr. Lisa Miller. And it has a bit of a backstory, so I want to share some of that with you too. I was actually chatting with some parents in a Facebook group a while back, and I mentioned that I'm always looking for podcast episode topics, and one of them suggested that I do one on this book. And so when I heard the title, Your Spiritual Child, my first thought was, well, that doesn't really sound like my cup of tea, but I'll read the book and see where it goes from there. So I read the book and I was pretty surprised. Dr. Miller makes all kinds of claims about the integral role that spirituality can play in a child's development. Her basic thesis is that children are naturally spiritual and that by not allowing them to develop this quality, we're depriving them of an essential ingredient in their success. But the really surprising part to me was that her claims are actually underpinned by scientific research. So I emailed Dr. Miller and I said, hey, I'm an atheist, but I read your book and I'd love to interview you on the show so we can dig into this and both my listeners and I can understand it a bit better. And she initially responded with something along the lines of, sounds great. But we had some scheduling difficulties and then I just stopped hearing back from her. And while those scheduling attempts were going on, I was doing all the background research that I normally do for an interview, and I started to get more and more worried. I was finding discrepancies between the outcome of the studies that Dr. Miller referenced and the way that she was describing them in the book, not in all cases, but in enough that I wanted to really dig into it further. So in the end, I emailed her and I told her what I'd found, and I explained that I was really interested in a rigorous intellectual discussion and I didn't have any malicious intent. And I invited her again to be on the show, but she just didn't respond. I did tell her that it would be a bit of a bummer for me to have gone through all that research and not have an episode to show for it, so that I would go ahead and do it without her if she decided not to participate. So here we are. All right, let's get started with the book. Dr. Miller defines spirituality as an inner sense of a living relationship to a higher power, which might be God, nature, spirit, universe, the creator, or whatever your word is for the ultimate loving, guiding life force. The important thing here is that spirituality is not necessarily tied to religion. It's about an individual's personal relationship with the transcendent, not about how organized religion might shape that experience. We actually know this through the results of a study of white Caucasian twins in Virginia by Kenneth Kendler, which asked the twins about their experience of spirituality and religion as part of understanding whether these could be protective against substance abuse. Researchers like to study twins because it's the closest thing that we have to two people who are identical but still have important differences between them, like their experience of spirituality. Dr. Miller says that by comparing monozygotic, which are twins from the same egg and that are thus genetically identical, with dizygotic twins, which came from two different eggs fertilized at the same time, so they're genetically different, our tendencies around spiritual devotion are due to 29% to broad heritability, 24% to family environment, and 47% to our own unique personal environment. Now, I actually couldn't find that result in Kendler's study. Those specific numbers aren't discussed anywhere. It's possible that Dr. Miller worked with the statistical results that are provided and devised those percentages, but they're not found in the paper. Later in the book, she calls him her senior colleague, so I actually wonder if she has access to data that isn't described in the paper. In the paper, Dr. Kendler finds that age and number of years of education are positively associated with personal devotion, which is what Dr. Miller calls transcendental relationships, and that none of the three dimensions of religiosity differed between the monozygotic and the dizygotic twins, although he doesn't mention those differences for personal devotion. So the upshot of all of that is that the tendency for spirituality seems to be partly inherited and partly a result of the way an individual interacts with the world. And it's also a different thing from religious affiliation, and that was corroborated by a follow-up study by Dr. Kendler. The first study also found that both spirituality and religion are associated with lower levels of alcohol and tobacco use, which is something we'll get into again later. Spirituality was inversely associated with depressive symptoms, indicating that people who experience spirituality are less likely to experience depression. And that actually wasn't the case for religion. But other than these findings, there were no significant correlations between spirituality or religiosity and any of 27 other mental illnesses. It seems to me as though organized religion is at a bit of a crossroads in the US. A Gallup poll that's updated annually finds that the percentage of people reporting none as their religion is increasing, and people reporting that they have a great deal of confidence in the church or organized religion is declining, while people who say they have very little confidence in these organizations is increasing. Yet 89% of people asked in 2016 if they believe in God will say yes, and that's down from the 96% who believed in 1944, but it's still really high. So what are all these people who believe in God but don't believe in organized religion tell their children? Dr. Miller quotes some of the parents that she's talked about as saying, "I don't want to share my views about spiritual things because I'm not sure myself. I could say something to steer my child in the wrong direction." Another one said, "I'm just not sure how to put it. There's nothing at all for parents that helps us to talk about spirituality other than religion. But I'm not religious, and I don't like the way that religion was taught to me." Many parents know that they don't want organized religion for their children, but they don't know what else to replace it with. In the book, Dr. Miller goes on to quote the studies that we've already discussed from Dr. Kendler a number of other times, so in each case I tried to corroborate the evidence from an alternate source. I did find one from Professor Ralph Piedmont of Loyola University, who wondered if spirituality could be considered a dimension making up a person that's different from all the other traits that make up a personality, and actually found that transcendence does indeed appear to be a different component of personality than other characteristics. So these studies point to the idea that at least part of our spirituality is a genetic component of our makeup, and not something that is something we learn through exposure to organized religion. Dr. Miller's second major finding is that while we might notice elements of and a curiosity about spirituality in young children, it really comes into its own in adolescence. And this fits with reading I've been doing for my classwork on adolescent development related to the identity exploration that adolescents often go through as they try on different identities to see which one fits them. It actually turns out that teenage angst and not wanting to be around parents very much are developmentally necessary things for adolescents to go through as they figure out who they are as separate beings from their parents. My expectation would have been that the influence of biology decreases over time as the child is exposed to more experiences over the course of her life. But a study Dr. Tanya Button at the University of Colorado did finds that at age 14, the largest impact on a teen's spirituality is from her family, but by age 19, it's primarily shaped by her biology. In other words, the biological changes of puberty in adolescence. When the researchers looked at the underlying causes of that shift, they found that it was about half due to the force of genetic expression, or the unlocking of the window, as Dr. Miller puts it, and the other half to the personal environment that teens create as they go through the search for their identity, things like going to a youth group or church or trying meditation. This shift in the influence of heritability was corroborated by Dr. Koenig at the University of Minnesota using another twin study. So we can actually be reasonably sure about the conclusion that there's a surge in the importance of biological factors in determining an adolescent's interest in spirituality. So all this brings us to the question, why should we care about spirituality? It's nice to believe nice things about the world and the people in it, but are there any real benefits to being spiritual? And this gets to the heart of the issues that I was having as I read through the research that Dr. Miller draws on for the book. Because as far as she's concerned, the evidence is pretty cut and dried, but it seems to me that it's rather less so. So let's take a look. We'll start with young children. Dr. Anat Shoshani studied 479 5-year-old children in Israel to find out what kinds of characteristics are linked to a child's adjusting well to school. Dr. Miller reports that the degree of the child's transcendent strengths based on spirituality, hope, humor, and gratitude were more predictive of a teacher's ratings on school adjustment than the child's other inborn capacities of intellect or temperament. That's her description of Dr. Shoshani's study. But it turns out that that's not really what the study said at all. It looked at four different types of school adjustment. Those were cognitive, behavioral, social, and emotional adjustment. And transcendent characteristics were indeed better related to good emotional adjustment by a really tiny amount. But for cognitive, behavioral, and social adjustment, there were other factors that were more important than transcendent strengths in every case. In fact, transcendent strengths weren't even among the top four factors for cognitive and behavioral adjustment. This study also brings up a methodological issue related to the study of spirituality. The Israeli study was the only one that I saw that included hope and humor as definitions of a transcendent strength. And it's entirely possible that these factors aren't really related to spirituality at all. Dr. Miller herself has done a lot of work related to spirituality and depression. She and her colleagues did a study looking at MRIs of people with high risk for depression. Some of those people reported religion or spirituality was important in their lives, and some people said it wasn't. They found that the outer layer of the brain, called the cortex, was thicker in some places in people who reported a high degree of religiousness and spirituality, and that a thinner cortex is associated with a certain type of familial risk of depression. They caution that they can't say which causes which or even if one causes the other. It's possible that people with thicker cortices like to go to church, or perhaps going to church altered the cortices in some way. We just don't know. In another study, Dr. Miller found that adults who reported that religion or spirituality was highly important to them had about a quarter the risk of experiencing major depression over the next 10 years compared with other participants. And this effect was most pronounced among those who were at a higher risk for depression by having a depressed parent, who had about one-tenth the risk of depression over the next 10 years than those who didn't find religion or spirituality important. This protective effect was found primarily against the recurrence rather than the onset of depression, which really wasn't adequately explained in the results. It's not clear to me why spirituality wouldn't protect you from getting depressed in the first place, but it does protect you from getting depressed again. But in another of Dr. Miller's studies, she assesses the impact of maternal religiosity as a protective factor against depression in offspring. One of her major points in that work is that overall, the findings do not support the hypothesis that offspring religiosity is protective against offspring major depressive disorder. In other words, just because a child is religious doesn't mean that they have any kind of protection against depression, which directly contradicts the results of the previous study. Another finding from that paper that if mother and child have similar spiritual beliefs, then the child is less likely to experience depression was cited in the spiritual child. So the factor that supports her argument is cited, and the factor that doesn't support her argument is not cited. Dr. Miller also looked at how spirituality and religiosity is associated with substance use and abuse in adolescence. And this is one of the few studies on spirituality that I've looked at that both males and females are considered. Researchers generally acknowledge that the relationship between spirituality and depression and other factors is stronger for females, so they'd usually just do studies on females and ignore males. So this research found that a variety of measures of religiousness and spirituality were associated with less use of alcohol, contraband drugs, and substance dependence or abuse, as long as you're some variety of Christian. The religious denominations that people could pick from were fundamentalist Protestant, Baptist, mainline Protestant, Roman Catholic, and other or unaffiliated as one category. And I kind of thought to myself, really? This sample claims to be nationally representative and participants could choose between two different types of Protestantism, but neither Judaism nor Islam is representative, and the atheists get lumped with the people who believe in God but not in organized religion. Anyway, that issue aside, the results of this study were actually pretty robust, but no association was found between substance abuse and a rigid adherence to creed, which implies that the way to protect adolescents from substance abuse is not to confine them within the rules of organized religion, but to support them in questioning rules and beliefs based on their spiritual experience. Finally, Dr. Miller has looked at the link between religiousness and sexual responsibility in a nationally representative survey of adolescent girls, and found that personal devotion, otherwise known as spirituality, is linked with having fewer sexual partners outside a romantic relationship. Frequent attendance of religious events was associated with a high perception of risk in contracting HIV or getting pregnant from unplanned intercourse, believing that contracting HIV or getting pregnant would cause a great deal of suffering, and also using birth control. But personal conservatism, which is otherwise known as a rigid adherence to spiritual texts, was positively associated with unplanned sex. I'll be exploring this item in an episode soon on sexuality, and this finding does go along with the research I've been doing for that. If you teach a child that sex is something they shouldn't do, then when it ends up happening, they find themselves unprepared for it. So it does seem as though spirituality is associated with behaviors that are less likely to lead to negative outcomes associated with less than responsible sexual behavior, as long as it's not confined within that rigid framework. In the upcoming episode on sexuality, we'll also talk about how the awesomeness of sexuality has been reduced to don't get pregnant and don't get HIV when we talk to children and teens. So stay tuned for more on that if you're interested. So if we can summarize these findings, we can say a few things. Firstly, there seems to be a genetic component to spirituality, which is why we see elements of spirituality even in very young children. We see a second big push in spirituality during puberty as part of the adolescent's drive to understand herself as a unique person and her place in the world. Secondly, there's some connection between spirituality and depression, but we're far from being able to say that having a spiritual practice causes the reduction in risk in depression. Thirdly, spirituality seems to protect against substance use and abuse in adolescence. Fourthly, spirituality is associated with responsible sexual behavior, while a high level of involvement in organized religion is linked to unplanned sex, although again, we can't say it causes it. Finally, you might have heard of a variety of other studies discussing the benefits of religion and spiritual practice on health, and I just want to encourage you to dig a bit deeper before you take those studies at face value. In most cases, the studies really aren't designed to measure the connection between spiritual factors and health. They often just throw in one question asking whether the participants in the study go to church and draw their conclusions from that. They very rarely attempt to understand the direction of the correlation, so we'd have no way of knowing whether church attendance actually causes the poor health or whether the individual started going to church when they got sick. I found a paper that reviewed 266 articles published in the year 2000 that were identified by the term religion in the literature databases, but only 17% of them were actually relevant to claims about health benefits associated with religious involvement. One study qualified as related to religion and health because the weight control program in the study happened to be held in a church, even though it had no religious component whatsoever. Others get cited by researchers as having a positive finding when actually the study had no significant effects. So if you do see information on this in the public media, do dig a little deeper before you accept the findings. So let's wrap up as we always do by asking what a parent is supposed to do with all this information. It does seem as though Dr. Miller has overstated the benefits associated with spirituality in at least a couple of instances where the results in the study she cites don't quite support her assertions. But the preponderance of the evidence leaves me thinking that there does seem to be some benefit for children and adolescents associated with spirituality. For the sake of completeness, I did review a couple of papers that discussed potentially negative associations between children and adolescents and religion. One was focused on the links between religion and things like cults and organized terrorism, which is kind of beyond the scope of this episode, although I do acknowledge the validity of the issue. The other was a review paper that presented a lot of disparate findings and made really no attempt to reconcile them. For example, it cited studies showing that religion may be linked to more skilled and effective parenting, parental warmth, and family cohesiveness. One of the studies it reviewed found that parents' level of endorsement of theologically conservative views about the Bible was reported to self-reports of more hugging and praising of preschool and school-aged children, and they were also less likely to yell at their children. But in another section of the same paper, it cited other studies showing that conservative Protestant parents of three-year-olds are more likely than other parents to believe that spanking is necessary and an effective way to gain immediate and long-term compliance, and they're also less likely to report feeling guilty about spanking. The researchers report that the parents' degree of biblical literalism or Christian fundamentalism is more important in predicting disciplinary attitudes than just being a member of a conservative Christian group. So, being theologically conservative means you hug and praise more often, but you also hit your kids and don't feel bad about it. The authors of the review paper don't attempt to reconcile these discrepancies, so either Christian parents must be raising some seriously confused children, or at least one of the cited papers has not correctly assessed how Christian parents interact with their children. There are also, of course, struggles within more mainstream religion, like the child abuse scandal that has occurred at the hands of Christian priests. Although I should note that this issue isn't confined to religious settings, authorities in England are right now investigating abuse at the hands of soccer coaches. And people in mainstream religions may encounter deep psychological trauma if they believe that they're being punished or abandoned by God in the face of major struggles. One study looked at patients who were terminally ill with heart failure and found that those who were struggling with their religious beliefs were more likely to suffer more serious depressive symptoms, which is a really serious mortality risk for people with advanced cardiac disease. And patients with HIV or AIDS can suffer poorer health if they hold a more rigid view of a punishing God compared to a compassionate or forgiving view of God, or a view of an impersonal higher power. So under certain circumstances, religion, perhaps more than spirituality, can be associated with harmful health outcomes. But if those sorts of physical and emotional crises can be avoided, the overall effect appears to be at least neutral or maybe beneficial. So we've seen that the impacts of spirituality are most apparent in the adolescent years. But what do we think is going to happen when we're suddenly open to talking about spirituality when our child turns 13, when we've essentially shut down all discussions on the topic until that point? Do we think our child is going to be interested in having that conversation with us then? I don't have a 13-year-old, but I was one once, and I think the foundation is going to be really critical here. I've mentioned the concept of synaptic pruning before, which is the idea that we're born with as many synapses in our brain as we will ever have, and our brains naturally prune or kill off the ones we don't use. This concept has been very well studied and is active in many aspects of a child's development, from her relationship with her mother to the way she learns language. So if we don't have these conversations with our young children, then the conversations our adolescents are able to have with us may not be as rich. You don't have to think of yourself as the teacher and the imparter of knowledge in this relationship. It's okay to use a model where you discuss things in a circular way, perhaps revisiting them and incorporating new information, and also letting the child get opinions from people other than you. Before we get to a list of ideas and practices that you can use to deepen your child's spiritual connection if you want to, I want to make the point that the definition of developmental success that's most entrenched in public policy as well as in our healthcare system is that health is the absence of disease. If there isn't something wrong, then everything must be okay. If you haven't listened to my recent interview with Dr. Claudia Gold, then you might want to do that. Her book talks about how the healthcare system allots doctors a minimal amount of time to diagnose symptoms related to ADHD in children, and then just prescribe medication to control those symptoms without ever making any attempt to understand, never mind address, the underlying causes. Bringing that idea back to spirituality, what if there's more to it than just avoiding unsafe sex and drug use, and spirituality could help our children to develop competencies to not just avoid pathologies, but to actively thrive? That's the part I find really attractive and why I'm going to keep thinking about this topic. Dr. Miller describes a lot of practices you can use to develop your child's spiritual connection over several chapters, and I'm going to summarize those for you in 6 major topics. The first of these is slow down. Allow times for unscheduled time to take walks and be alone and think and talk about the wonders of life. The second is teach children that science is a valid way of knowing the world, and also that their personal experience is another valid way of knowing the world. Both analytical and intuitive abilities are a critical part even of a scientific skill set. Number 3, encourage children to take an interest in the things and the people around them. Don't let subjects be off limits. Don't say, well, that's Charlie's problem, not yours, or if she needs help, she'll ask the teacher, or homelessness is a big problem, and yeah, it's really sad to see someone homeless, but don't worry, you have a home and a family that loves you. Young children experience the suffering of other people and even animals directly, as if it was their own suffering. They worry about the lost duckling in the park or put a crumb of bread down for the ants on the sidewalk, so help them to value their authentic experience and connection with other people and other things. Related to that, fourthly, don't avoid difficult questions. Dr. Miller actually gives the example of racism, which describes some of the studies that I cite in my podcast episode on racism, as ways that people can really feel racism for themselves. And don't just wait for them to ask you, ask them. When they mention someone feeling down and out, ask if they've ever felt that way. Ask what they would do in that situation. Ask why their favorite cartoon characters are motivated to act in the way that they do. And ask questions that don't have neat answers where good wins and bad loses. Fifthly, just like the way racism develops by children preferring people who look like them, by around age 6, many religious children will rate their God as being more omniscient than the God that somebody else who lives really far away believes in. So try and have discussions about what different people believe so they can respect spirituality in other people and other cultures. This acceptance of all religions and types of spirituality will also stand you in good stead if your adolescent decides that they don't like your version of religion. At least then you still have the common ground of respect and spirituality. And then finally, children might often feel powerless because we call so many of the shots in their lives, but with spirituality, it's a different story. Every child has the power to notice things that aren't right and take responsibility for trying to put them right, whether it's cheating or bullying or just doing the right thing. Encourage them to think for themselves and speak up when they see something that isn't right. And this will stand them in really good stead as teenagers when they know what is the right thing to do, but they don't feel compelled to act according to their moral standards. If you've been helping them to maintain these synaptic pathways for a decade already, then that teen might be able to use her inner voice to make better decisions for herself. So what is this atheist going to do with all this information? Well, for right now, actually not that much differently. We already make time for digging in sand on the beach and wading around in creeks after the rain. And we celebrate moments like unpacking the groceries together as points of real connection between us. We buy lunch for the homeless man who sits outside our grocery store, and we always take a minute to engage with him as a real person. As my toddler gets older, I feel a bit better prepared to help her think through some of the big questions about life that she might have. And I certainly won't be sending her off to church anytime soon, but if she decides to go herself at some point in the future, then I'm open to it. Thanks, as always, for listening. You can find references for the 21 books, articles, and websites that I read to prepare for this episode at yourparentingmojo.com/spiritual.
Thanks for joining us on this episode of Your Parenting Mojo. Please subscribe, rate, and review the show on iTunes, and sign up for our mailing list at yourparentingmojo.com to receive a free gift. 7 relationship-based strategies to support your children's development while making parenting just a little bit easier on you. For more respectful, research-based parenting ideas to help kids thrive, we'll see you next time on Your Parenting Mojo.